What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder Magazine. How about that?
Smoke weed every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Welcome back. Today is Friday, January 27th, and I'm Sean Yoon.
And I'm Francesca Bianco. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5.03 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
To start the show, we have News 101 reporter Andrew Seale's report on the availability of French-speaking healthcare professionals in BC.
Following that, we have former News co-director and News 101 reporter Rohit Joseph's report on the Women's March in Vancouver, which took place on Saturday, January 21st.
Next up, Sahara Saf interviewed Black Lives Matter Vancouver member and organizer Joy Giamfi to find out more about the lack of inclusivity in Saturday's Women's March on Washington in Vancouver. Joy speaks about her reaction to the apology posted by the Women's March on Washington on the Women's March in Vancouver's Facebook page and what needs to be done going forward.
And finally, we have Sharon Nadim's report on Vancouver's annual Dine Out Festival, which took place this week. Sharon visited the food trucks along Howe Street and spoke to attendees.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, Premier Christy Clark appoints UBC President Santo Ono as Chief Advisor of Innovation Network. Premier Clark announced the new position and Ono's appointment on January 23rd. The Innovation Network is a new initiative designed to attract and keep talent in BC's tech sector. Ono previously held a similar role on the advisory board for the Ohio Third Frontier during his time at the University of Cincinnati. The government initiative is seeking to capitalize on instability in the UK and the United States and attract between 10 and 200,000 highly skilled workers by 2025. Liberal Minister of Advanced Education Andrew Wilkinson said, "The Brexit decision gives an opportunity for all kinds of people who have a more worldly view to say they'd like to go to a more outwardly welcoming place, like Canada." Ono hopes new degree programs at UBC, as well as opportunities with companies like Microsoft, Amazon, and Hootsuite, will help drive to attract and retain talent in the city. Wilkinson said that the initiative also aims to help local companies expand instead of sending their intellectual property elsewhere. Ono said, "For this to succeed, we really need everyone to come together and roll up their sleeves and work hard. Every indication that I have now is that people are ready to do so." The recently announced expansion of the Millennium Line will not extend all the way to UBC. The extension was announced by Mayor Gregor Robertson at a press conference last weekend. The plan will see the line run down Broadway, but only as far as Arbutus Street, ending well short of UBC. There has been some talk of extending the line all the way to the university campus. However, it is not part of the City Council's current 10-year plan. TransLink CEO Kevin Desmond said at a press conference, "Will rail eventually get to UBC? I'd say that's probably a good chance." He also said, "When? I don't know, but for now, we have to get to Arbutus and relieve a lot of crowding on bus service." The extension will include 6 kilometers of new track and 6 new underground stations running diagonally from VCC Clark Station to Main and Broadway, where it will then run underneath Broadway to Arbutus. The 99B line bus service, the busiest in North America, will continue to be the only way to get to UBC. According to TransLink, if funding from all 3 levels of government is confirmed in 2017, construction could begin as early as 2019. TransLink is holding 3 open houses on the Broadway extension on January 28th, January 31st, and February 1st. An online survey is currently open until February.
In local news, Vancouver Heritage Homes are now eligible for grants to reduce carbon footprint. Vancouver's Heritage homeowners can now get extra cash to help with their renovation costs. The Vancouver Heritage Foundation, for the next 2 years, will assist in offering energy retrofitting grants of up to $6,000 to help homeowners of heritage buildings to reduce their carbon footprint. Foundation's director, Judith Mosley, said the grant helps homeowners to find the most effective retrofits for their home that reduces both the greenhouse gas emissions, their energy bills, and improves the comfort in their homes. The City of Vancouver is footing the bill for the new grants, which will be available for the next 2 years after a successful pilot run began in 2015. Homeowners have until October 31st, 2018, to complete their retrofits, including a post-retrofit evaluation, in order to receive the full grant. TransLink announces accountability dashboard for public to check on its performance. TransLink launched a new data-driven webpage called the Accountability Center this Thursday that is meant to make the transit company more accountable to the public. TransLink CEO Kevin Desmond said, "Transparency is important. I think it's important for any organization." TransLink's page gathers information that is already reported by TransLink and its operating companies such as Coast Mountain Bus Company and the Transit Police on a monthly, quarterly, or annual basis and puts it on one page under 3 headings, regional snapshot, performance dashboard, and transparency. The regional snapshot gives readers a brief overview of the transit network. The performance dashboard contains the most recent figures for ridership, customer satisfaction, safety and security, service quality, efficiency, and environment. Reports, agendas, and minutes are posted under the transparency tab. 30 performance measures are available for view. Desmond said, quote, "It's a lot, but it gives the public a chance to see what's going on at TransLink," end quote. He also added, quote, "By providing this information to the public, it's in part a glimpse into what we see as important in managing the performance of the system and showing what the performance is," end quote.
In national news, U.S. President Donald Trump said on Sunday he plans to soon begin renegotiating NAFTA, under which Canada and Mexico send most of their exports to the United States. Canada will focus on preserving its U.S. trade ties during talks to renegotiate NAFTA and may not be able to help Mexico avoid being targeted by the Trump administration, Canadian government sources say. A source on the sidelines of a cabinet retreat in Calgary, Alberta, said, "We love our Mexican friends, but our national interests come first and the friendship comes second." The government dismisses the idea that Canada will formally abandon Mexico. Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland said on Tuesday that Canada supported NAFTA as a trilateral agreement and noted that Trudeau had talked to Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto over the weekend. Bilateral trade is critical for Canada, which sends 75% of its exports to the United States. Statistics Canada data for 2015 show two-way trades in goods with the U.S. totaled $760 billion Canadian dollars compared to just $26 billion with Mexico. Derek Burney, a former Canadian ambassador to Washington, told CTV News on Monday that Canada should distance itself from Mexico on NAFTA. He said, "We have security agreements, both continental and multilateral. Mexico does not. Mexico has a huge border problem with the United States in terms of immigration and drugs. Canada does not." Will the Keystone XL pipeline be good for Canada? Depends on who you ask. President Donald Trump signed a number of executive orders Tuesday to support construction of TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline project, which was first commissioned in 2010, and if completed, would transport over 20% of Canada's oil exports to its southern neighbor. The executive orders effectively give TransCanada the green light to reapply to build the pipeline extension. Trump's predecessor, Barack Obama, killed the proposed pipeline in late 2015, saying it would hurt American efforts to reach a global climate change deal. With Trump now following through on his campaign promise to approve the project, Canadian players remain divided on whether any job creation and energy supplying potential is worth the environmental impact. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Tuesday the pipeline extension would help Canada balance energy needs with environmental commitments. He said, "We can continue to support good jobs, including in the fossil fuel industry, while we improve our emission standards, while we innovate and develop renewable resources, while we manage the long-term transition that the planet needs to go through." The federal government is implementing a pan-Canadian climate change framework that includes a price on carbon, he said. He further added that Alberta has put a cap on emissions and that pipelines are a safer option than rail cars. Canadian environmental groups disagreed, suggesting that a pipeline's project's job-creating potential was exaggerated and its environmental footprint underplayed. Mike Hudema, a climate and energy campaigner for Greenpeace Canada, urged Trudeau to defy Trump on Keystone XL. Hudema said in a statement that, quote, "The question for Canadians is, will the Prime Minister continue to align himself with the climate-denying Trump administration, or will he stand with the people and with science and start living up to his own commitments to the climate and Indigenous rights?" Another environmental group, Environmental Defence Canada, stated, "With the recent approval of Line 3 in Kinder Morgan, there is no more room for pipelines under Alberta's legislated cap on tar sand emissions. Canada's carbon budget cannot accommodate an additional 830,000 barrels per day of pipeline capacity and the estimated 22 additional megatons of upstream emissions the pipeline would enable." But Natural Resources Minister Jim Carr said the government continues to maintain its twin pillars of the economy and the environment, and Keystone XL doesn't sway that balance. Carr also said, "We believe that it is possible to have sustainable economic growth, creating important jobs in the energy sector, while at the same time maintaining our commitments to a lower carbon economy in the long term."
In international news, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto cancels his upcoming meeting with Trump over the proposed wall. On Wednesday, the new American president, following a campaign promise, signed an executive order to start construction of the wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. The wall is estimated to cost $8 billion or more and will be funded by the U.S., although Trump has maintained that Mexico will reimburse the cost. Mr. Peña Nieto responded on Twitter by stressing that Mexico will not pay for the wall and chided the move by Washington. Mr. Trump fired back, warning that he may cancel the meeting himself if Mexico does not agree to pay for the wall. The back and forth on Twitter culminated in Nieto canceling the meeting later this week. The move by the Mexican president brings to a head the simmering tension between the two leaders, decades of friendly relations between the nations on matters involving trade, security, and migration seem to be unraveling. Mr. Trump's executive order is just one in a series he has signed this week, including one that approves the Keystone and Dakota Access pipelines. The doomsday clock was moved up 30 seconds on Thursday, issuing its most dire warning since the Cold War. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists announced that the clock now stands at 2.5 minutes to midnight, suggesting that existential threats now pose a greater danger to humanity than they have at any time since the height of the Cold War. The doomsday clock is a symbolic warning about how close the world stands to midnight, that is, the nuclear existential catastrophe. The clock was set up in 1947 by scientists who helped build the world's first atomic bomb and has been updated annually since then. Many of the world's most acclaimed scientists, including Stephen Hawking, Susan Solomon, Lisa Randall, and Freeman Dyson, sponsor, oversee, or consult with the Bulletin. The last time that the timer was closer to midnight was in 1953, when the United States and the Soviet Union both tested hydrogen bombs. The clock no longer focuses only on dangers of nuclear apocalypse. Since 2007, it has countenanced other existential threats like climate change and biological weapons. The scientists of the bulletin specified that they were taking the action out of specific concern for the words of two men, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. Not in the 70-year history of the clock had rhetoric from so few individuals so affected the movement of the clock, they said. So these are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Fate, sex, God. Everyone has a secret. In a series of tantalizing vignettes, over 100 characters search for love and information.
They discover themselves and each other through tango, torture, and karaoke.
UBC Theater and Film presents Love and Information.
Written by influential and award-winning playwright Carol Churchill.
And directed by MFA candidate Lauren Taylor.
For tickets, visit theaterfilm.ubc.ca.
Boost your resume by studying abroad and get that dream job. Don't miss the Graduate School Fair at The Nest, UBC, on Wednesday, March 1st, or the Study and Go Abroad Fair on Thursday, March 2nd, at the Vancouver Convention Center. Admission is free. Come early to catch our feature seminar on scholarships. For more info, visit our website at www.studyandgoabroad.com.
Now we have News 101 reporter Andrew Seal's report on the availability of French-speaking healthcare professionals in British Columbia.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to News 101. This is Andrew Seal reporting. Statistics Canada recently released its report on the availability of healthcare professionals and official language minorities in Canada. According to the study, the number of professionals in British Columbia who reported using French at work increased to 1,415 in 2011. Furthermore, British Columbia was the only province to have seen an increase in Francophone healthcare professionals that corresponds to demographic change. So, I decided to get in contact with some members of Vancouver's Francophone community to see what their experiences have been trying to get medical services in French. Eric Dubois, a social worker with the Francophone social services provider La Bozole, says he has to rely on a very limited pool of French-speaking healthcare professionals in Vancouver. Quote, "I juggle between two or three GPs in town that are Francophone," unquote, says Dubois. According to him, many doctors on the list of French-speaking healthcare professionals compiled by the French-language healthcare organization Réseau Santé do not provide adequate services in the language. Some of the doctors on the list might have taken French somewhere in their college years, but it doesn't mean that they're actually giving services in French. It doesn't mean that the whole process is going to be in French. It doesn't mean that the receptionist or the nurses will speak French, unquote, says Dubois. Dubois also noted the low availability of translation services. The Provincial Language Service does provide interpretation services. However, the wait time can be up to 6 months. This seems to be having an impact on the city's homeless population, over 10% of whom are French-speaking. Quote, "That is a very disproportionate number to their 1.5% share of the overall population. The limited access to services in French might not be a cause of homelessness, but it does preserve it," unquote, says Dubois. A lack of readily available information for French speakers regarding healthcare and other services has younger people turning to Facebook. Laura Bozid, a receptionist at Société Francophonie de Mallardville, says access to services in French is extremely limited to British Columbians outside of downtown Vancouver. Quote, "When I arrived in Vancouver, I exclusively relied on a Facebook group for information and services in French. Without this Facebook group, it would have been very complicated for me to get this information," unquote, says Bozid. Many people in Mallardville Francophone community see English-speaking doctors for less important matters. However, some community members have had success finding French-speaking doctors using Réseau Santé's list of professionals. Dubois thinks that increased funding will help make services more available and increase awareness. In conclusion, he says, quote, what we need is a French multidisciplinary team with proper funding. Right now, we're about 1.5 social workers. We used to have a nurse. We used to have a psychiatrist a couple times a week. All that is gone. Unquote. So that's all for now, guys. Hope to follow up on this story in the coming weeks. But for now, it's back to you in the studio.
Thank you, Andrew. Now we have News 101 reporter and former News co-director Rohit Joseph's report on the Women's March in Vancouver, which took place on Saturday, January 21st.
But first, we're going to take a quick PSA break. Stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Considering a master's, MBA, or doctoral degree? Mark Wednesday, March 1st in your calendar and get over to the UBC Nest for the Graduate School Fair. Or do you want to study, work, or volunteer abroad? Get down to the Vancouver Convention Center on Thursday, March 2nd to visit the Study and Go Abroad Fair. Both events are free. Check online at studyandgoabroad.com for more info.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Now we have News 101 reporter and former News co-director Rohit Joseph's report on the Women's March in Vancouver, which took place on Saturday, January 21st.
I'm walking up Thurlow right now, Thurlow and Pender, trying to catch the march as it goes on. Tons of people from Thurlow and Pender to, looks like even in Georgia, there's people filling the entire street, 3-4 blocks. You can hear the cheers. Lots of women wearing pink hats and signs of solidarity with the Washington March. Build bridges, not walls. That's the chant you're hearing. So first of all, I just wanted to ask, what's your name?
My name's Linda.
Okay.
Linda Clements.
Linda Clements. And what's your name?
Joyce McLean.
Joyce McLean. And are you guys related?
Mother-daughter.
Mother-daughter. Yeah. So I see your sign here. What does it say, Joyce? Can you tell us what your sign says? Oh, okay, sure.
Okay, learn to do right, seek justice, defend the oppressed.
All right. So what brought you, so first of all, where are you guys coming from? Are you locals or are you coming from elsewhere?
We're locals, yes. Okay. And we thought that it was really important to come and join and support and lend our support to women and girls and people around the world.
All right.
Yeah.
And have you ever been to like a rally before? Is this like your first time?
Many rallies. A few rallies. I'll just say a few rallies, yeah.
And how about your mother?
A rally or two in her life, I'd say.
Well, really cool to see you here. And did you guys manage to get... What did you think of the whole thing? I was just wanting to say...
Well, we did get here a little late. Yeah. And I have to tell you that this sign was given to Mom today.
Awesome.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It was given to Mom today, yeah.
Well, it's a great sign. And just out of curiosity, you know, do you feel like you want to still stay active? Do you feel this urge to be more politically active in this Trump era?
Yes, it certainly... reignited some sparks to get back into activity and give a little bit more. Yeah.
And what would you say to people out there that are maybe not politically active but want to get into it? What would you tell them?
One foot forward, one day at a time, baby steps, and everything makes a difference.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Say you're welcome.
No.
Oh, thank you very much. Very nice.
Thank you. My name is Samad Jaffer, and I was here today really just representing myself, but I work at SFU's Van City Office of Community Engagement, as well as I'm a student, and I'm the evening editor at Rabble.ca.
Awesome. So just a quick thing, what specifically brought you here today?
Well, of course, I was here today because I was really encouraged to hear that Vancouver was hosting a march in solidarity with the Women's March on Washington in Washington, D.C., which is obviously a very historic movement. And so I was encouraged to hear that, and I was then asked to speak. And I thought that it was really important to come here today to talk about the relationship that exists between racism, colonialism, and the patriarchy, and because we can't really talk about or even begin to think about or talk about women's rights unless we talk about the rights of people of color and the kind of systemic racism and oppression that exists in Canada against people of color as well as our Indigenous people.
So speaking of that, the rally today was like united by the whole anti-Trump sentiment, but as you mentioned in your speech and right now, we have some issues in Canada. So either from your personal experience or from what you know, what are some of those things that we have to tackle here in Canada or even in Vancouver?
I think in Canada we're very we're often really comfortable, or we often think that, you know, that the things that we're seeing happening down in the United States, the kind of hateful rhetoric and all of that, is kind of restricted and confined. And I've heard many people who even have said to me right after the election of Trump that, oh, you know, we're just so lucky that we live in Canada, which, of course, we are lucky to a certain extent, but so many of those issues are not restricted and limited by the borders. We have hateful speech. We have, we've seen rise in hate crimes, especially against Muslim women who wear hijab and Islamophobia. And the kind of, we saw the same rhetoric in our last federal election in 2015, and so we really aren't much different here. And kind of watching the conservative leadership race right now, you see that we have the very potential to having one of our very own Trumps right here in Canada. So I think that it's really naive to think that we're just in solidarity for what's going on in the United States. We have our own problems and issues that we really need to confront right now.
One last thing I'd want to ask you, being, you know, somebody who's visibly Muslim, how would you want to reach out to people who support like a Trump or, you know, people who are not from a different political ideology than ourselves? Because this rally today probably had a lot of people who believe in the same ideologies. But how do we bridge that gap?
Of course. I think that it's critical that we are constantly engaging in dialogue, constantly having our voices and our viewpoints heard, and having conversations that are going to be difficult. None of this is going to be easy. It's going to take a lot of work and a lot of dialogue and a lot of working together with people with differences. And I think the first thing is that we need to realize is that people of color are not going to be able to are not going to be recognized as equal until everyone is recognized as equal, and it's going to really take. It's going to be a huge kind of onus on our white citizens, our white brothers and sisters, and to kind of advocate for everyone else's rights, because we can't. Yeah, we can't talk about the rights of the equality of women or the equality of all citizens unless we're talking about the equality of people of color.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. No worries.
Superficial to be, 'cause we're hiding.
Tired of the gender binary?
Thank you, Rohit. Next up, Sahara Saf interviewed Black Lives Matter Vancouver member and organizer Joy Gyamfi to find out more about the lack of inclusivity in Saturday's Women's March on Washington and Vancouver. Joy speaks about her reaction to the apology posted by the Women's March on Washington on the Women's March in Vancouver's Facebook page and what needs to be done going forward. So what was your reaction to the statement issued yesterday afternoon by the organizers of the Women's March, in which they apologized for failing to include Black Lives Matter in the movement?
I really appreciate that they had finally taken the time to apologize. I think that was something that was one of the main issues that we were facing. We were asking at least for them to recognize that they had made a mistake. But another issue was we weren't asking for them to include Black Lives Matter specifically. It was more that they had forgotten about Black and trans voices in organizing the march.
So it was like a general issue of inclusivity.
Yeah, that was one of the main issues, was that they had just not thought to include the marginalized voices within the women's community.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they adequately addressed that in their apology?
I think they did, but they seem to have focused on Black Lives Matter specifically, and which, again, I don't think was the main issue. They could have, I'm reading the statement right now, and it says that they forgot to include Black Lives Matter, and all they mention is Black Lives Matter, but not really Black women or trans women or disabled women, which I think is something that media outlets have been forgetting to focus on. And not that it's Black Lives Matter should have specifically been involved, but that it's, these Black and trans and disabled women.
So just for our listeners, I just want to add that the organizers also deleted a post by Black Lives Matter on the Women's March Vancouver Facebook page. Is that correct?
Yeah, just to correct, we didn't personally post on the event page, someone else had posted the link to our statement on the event page. But yes, they had deleted the thread that had hundreds of comments that were including discussion and why Black and trans women should have been included in the march and trying to let the organizers know that this had been a mistake.
So how did that make you feel when they deleted that post?
It was really upsetting because it felt like, well, not felt like, but they were literally erasing all the work that other women and other people were doing in the post to try to educate the organizers. And it kind of just felt like, oh, we made a mistake, but we don't want to hear what we've done wrong, so we're just going to delete it to forget about it, which that, deleting it is not going to make the problem go away.
So in your view, why didn't the Women's March organizers include multiple voices, especially given that the Trump administration is going to disproportionately affect people of color?
I think, honestly, it's probably just something that they forgot, and which sucks because that's one of a really big problem with white feminism, is that they're all for women's rights, and I am too, but they seem to forget the marginalized women within these women, the Black women that are going to be affected by Trump's administration, the trans women, the disabled are going to be affected. So, yeah, I understand that they made a mistake, and they have also mentioned that they had time constraints, which, again, I understand. But, those aren't good enough excuses. Organizing an event is difficult, but it's up to the organizers to seek out the voices that should be represented.
The Women's March on Washington was arguably more diverse. There were women like Tamika Mallory, Linda Sarsour, Carmen Perez, just to name a few. Why didn't we see this kind of diversity here?
That was probably a mistake from the organizers. They had just, in their organizing, had just simply forgot, which is part of the larger problem, is that when planning a march like this, they had not thought about the further marginalized voices. And it's interesting because the original organizers of the Women's March are, I believe, an Arab woman and a Black woman, and they would, I imagine that they would have wanted to see diversity in every March and not just in the Wash, in the main one.
Mm-hmm. So it was almost unintentional.
Yeah, I do believe that it was unintentional, but they had further made it an issue when they had erased the thread. Like, that was intentional, or also after the erasure of the thread, people commenting on the event page, they were sort of like censored. Like, you couldn't just have a comment anymore. It had to be approved. So that was intentional, mm-hmm. I believe.
So in your view, how can we have more meaningful and effective conversations about inclusivity in movements, especially in Canada, ones that encompass, you know, intersecting race, class, and sexual orientation identities?
Well, I think the main thing is to listen to the people that are from these intersections, like listen to the Black women, listen to the trans women and Indigenous people, women of color, when they're telling you these things, because we had a lot of issues when posting the statement, and also when I saw that it was posted on the event page where a lot of white women were commenting and not seeing why this was an issue. And that's one of the things that is frustrating, is that when you're not even listening to these voices, it shows how much you don't really value intersectional feminism.
Have they adequately addressed deleting that post? Because it seems like they've apologized for not including Black Lives Matter in the movement, but they haven't addressed deleting that post.
Yeah, in my opinion, they haven't really adequately apologized. They have apologized, but they haven't done it adequately. Like, for example, it is the Women's March on Washington that actually posted this apology on the event page. Nothing has come from the Vancouver section themselves, from my understanding. So it almost seems as if the Women's March in Washington, like the Canada section, was like, oh, this smaller section of us has made a mistake, we have to fix that, rather than the Vancouver organizers themselves trying to fix the mistake on their own, if that makes sense.
So going forward, how can we make sure intersectional feminism actually materializes in movements like the Women's March?
Yeah, I think it's about, again, listening to the voices that are further marginalized and actually, I guess, like, not just talking about it, but doing something about it. Like, we were really grateful to the people that were commenting on the thread, giving, like, having concrete discussion and thoughts as to how this the march could have been more diverse. So I guess more action and less just speaking.
Mm-hmm. So also in your statement on your website, the one that was released the night before the march, you also mentioned how there are people in Canada who claim that there is no racism, and you've received a number of threats online. So where is this narrative that there's no racism in Canada coming from?
I think this narrative comes from Canadians comparing themselves to the States. It's like, oh, we're not as bad as the States, so there can't be racism here, which is absolutely not the case at all. If you had heard of the KKK posters being distributed in Richmond and I think perhaps New West, like that area, like that shows that racism does exist here, and it's not just an American issue. It is definitely a Canadian issue, and the fact that people want to say, no, this is an issue, and majority of the time this comes from white people saying, no, this is not an issue, it, again, just further highlights that racism, where white people don't want to accept that people of color here do face racism.
We also saw this issue of diversity and inclusivity earlier last year during the Pride March as well. So does it feel like, you know, there are definitely parallels between what happened there and what happened over here with the Women's March. Does it feel like we're actually, you know, growing and learning from these situations?
Mm-hmm. I think it is a balance. I don't know if you heard recently that Black Lives Matter Toronto was able to get Toronto Pride to not allow the police floats in the parade, I believe.
Yes.
So that felt like, okay, something is happening. But then to have this reaction from the Women's March, it starts to feel like, well, I thought we were going somewhere. So I think there's always ups and downs. We have our wins and our losses. So definitely felt like a loss.
In the statement that was posted on the Black Lives Matter movement website, you also talked about the opportunity that Canada has to create a counter narrative to what's happening in the United States. So moving forward, how can we ensure that multiple voices and perspectives are included in crafting an effective and meaningful counter narrative?
Yeah, so I think it's about reaching out to those underrepresented voices. Like, I remember reading the comments on the post after our statement was posted, and a lot of people were saying, well, it's an open march, like anyone could have come, which is not the main issue. The main issue is that no trans or black women were meaningfully invited to speak. So yes, of course, it's an open march, anyone could have attended, but it's that they didn't think to ask these voices to speak. They didn't have the space for these voices to meaningfully convey the issues that they're facing. So it's about actually reaching out to these underrepresented and marginalized groups and saying, here, we want you to speak and tell us what we can do, or what is happening, how can we fix it. The two main issues with the march were, first, that the organizers hadn't thought to consider a more diverse, hadn't thought to consider black and trans women on the speakers list, which is like meaningfully inviting people. And then the second issue was when our statement was released, the thread containing all these meaningful comments were also deleted.
In the statement released by the Women's March organizers, they've said, quote, "We have reached out to Black Lives Matter today and hope that we can work together to provide meaningful inclusion in the days and weeks ahead." So will you be meeting up with them? Will you be kind of collaborating or having discussions with them about how the march ensued?
Yeah, so they have reached out to us, and we will be thinking of having a meeting with them soon. And we will also be including third parties and moderators as well, so that there can be like a balance.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
No problem at all.
Thank you, Sahir. We have Sharon Nadim's report on Vancouver's annual Dine Out Festival, which took place this week. Sharon visited the food trucks along Howe Street and spoke to attendees.
Parked along Howe Street between... Hi, so I'm standing here at the corner of Robson and Howe at the Dine Out Food Festival in Vancouver, where about 15 food trucks have parked along Howe Street between Georgia and Smith. The atmosphere is lively here and everybody seems to be enjoying the food trucks. There is definitely a variety of food trucks here, ranging from Pan-Asian food to grilled cheese. Let's talk to a few people here. Okay, so are you guys coming here for the first time?
Yep. Yes.
Yep. And how do you like it so far?
Pretty good. But the Bavarian cream and Nutella one is really good.
It's good.
Yeah. Really good.
There's a lot of variety of food and we like it. Yeah.
Yeah. And did you guys come here just for this? Did you know about it before?
Yeah, I do.
And would you guys come here again if it was going on every year?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Everyone's having a great time. The aroma of the foods is very apparent in the air. Here's what a food truck vendor had to say.
Today.
Okay, you've been here 2 days?
2 days. We started yesterday and we're here today and then again on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. And how has it been so far?
Very busy. The weather's been nice. People have been nice. It's, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
And do you like how many food trucks there are here? And is that
I think there's enough people walking by that there's enough trucks. You know, it's not too many trucks, we'll say. There's enough people for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And will you be here next year then?
With hopes, fingers crossed, if they have us back.
With the food truck vendors all really busy serving their hungry customers, I turned my attention towards Aroka, a woman who's been coming every day for 30 years to Howe and Robson to sell her warm sweaters and rings.
Selling in the summer dresses and tops right now, hats and sweaters and shawls and rings and gloves.
And you're here every day?
I'm here as much as I can be. Sometimes on the rain, I'll take days off.
Mm-hmm. And
How has your business been going for the last, like,
Dino? I think it helps a bit this week with the dine out, because it makes people think there's more festivities going on. Not a lot, because it's not busy this time of year, but it helps a little, maybe 10% more, something, 20% more. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and have you eaten at the food trucks yet?
I'm on a diet, I would. They look good, but I bring my own food.
There you have it. Not everybody eats at the food truck, but everyone enjoys the festivities and the happiness that's been going around at the Dine Out Festival. And yes, the weather's been helping. This is Sharon Nadeem for News 101.
Thank you, Sharon. That's our program for January 27th. Today's newscast was brought to you by talented volunteer efforts. If you would like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our Facebook, Twitter, or email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/radio/news/101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud and MixCloud pages. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Sean Yoon.
And I'm Francesca. Today's broadcast was produced by Sahara Saf and Andrew Seal. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening.
After this next segment, stay tuned for Sean Harbottle's Hippity Hoppity Brigade at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Are you interested in Indigenous issues?
Are you down with decolonization?
Do you have something to say?
Or have a topic to share?
We have just the thing.
Join UBC's first ever Indigenous Radio Collective.
We're a team of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people.
I'm Niska from my mother.
From the Tahltan Territory.
I'm a settler from Washington State.
I'm from the Qualicum and Musqueam First Nations.
I am Quechua Indigenous from Saraguro, Ecuador.
We broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land
of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Whatever you want to talk about, we're into it.
Everyone is welcome, no experience necessary.
Unceded Airwaves airs every Wednesday from 1 to 2 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
And we meet every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. to plan our upcoming shows.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Unceded Airwaves.
We want to hear your story.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here.
God. Oh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody.
God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Isn't there anything, 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 anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?